the meeting for Monday, January the 22nd. On the agenda today, this is an informational meeting, and we'll be taking overviews from the Land Use Board of Appeals, the Water Resources Department, Associated Oregon Industries, and the Oregon Farm Bureau. And to start us off this morning, we have Tom Basham from the Land Use Board of Appeals. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Todd Basham. Sorry. I'm the board chair of the Land Use Board of Appeals, and I understand my assignment today is to give you a brief overview of the land use review appellate process and LUBA's, with specific reference to LUBA's role in that process. I've prepared a handout, a four-page handout that you may have. There's two pages that describe a narrative describing LUBA's role, and there are two pages that give a flowchart of the local land use proceedings that can apply, and then the proceedings before LUBA, and I'll talk briefly about those. In terms of our mission and goals, our primary mission is to decide, review land use decisions as correctly or as quickly and as accurately and correctly as possible. LUBA was created by the 1979 legislature to address concerns that the state circuit courts were taking too long to review land use decisions and were doing so in a manner that was inconsistent and wasn't building a body of usable land use law. LUBA is the first form of its kind in the nation. There are now other states that have followed in creating something similar to LUBA, but LUBA was the first of its kind. And LUBA is not a policy-making agency. We are a quasi-judicial appellate review body. We're essentially like the umpires in a baseball game. Our job is to call balls and strikes as accurately and fairly and as quickly as possible. The basic framework for land use policies are set by the legislature. The state agency that adopts and implements that framework is the Department of Land Conservation and Development, DLCD. And they serve as staff of the Land Conservation and Development Commission, LCDC. LCDC adopts and amends the statewide planning goals and then adopts rules to implement those goals. Those goals are then implemented by local governments, cities, and counties, and placed into their comprehensive plan and their land use regulations. And then local governments make land use decisions based upon their comprehensive plans and their land use regulations for the most part. And then those land use decisions can be appealed to LUBA. LUBA's organization, we currently have three board members that are appointed by the governor and approved or confirmed by the Senate. LUBA board members must be lawyers admitted to practice in Oregon, and we currently have a four-person staff consisting of a staff attorney, some administrative support staff, and a copy editor, publications person. As mentioned, our primary program is to decide appeals of land use decisions as quickly and as accurately as possible, and to issue our opinions in a manner that builds a consistent body of land use law that's usable and can be used to guide local governments and parties in the future. LUBA's rules and procedures are intended to move cases as quickly and as cheaply as possible through the appellate review process while preserving the rights of the participants to a fair review. Approximately 20-25% of participants before LUBA are not represented by counsel. They're what are called pro se participants. And LUBA's rules and procedures are intended to be used by persons not represented by counsel as well as those who are represented by counsel. The legislature has established a $175 filing fee and a cost for deposits. LUBA's rules establish a $150 deposit cost, so the basic upfront cost to file a LUBA fee is $325. Some or all of which may be repaid depending upon who is the prevailing party. The statute also provides an award of attorney fees to the prevailing party in certain circumstances. LUBA has a limited scope of review. We can't review just any argument. The statutes provide what kind of arguments we can consider. The main ones include challenges that a decision is not supported by substantial evidence, that it misconstrues the applicable law, or fails to demonstrate compliance with the applicable law. And in reviewing challenges based on substantial evidence or interpretations of local government provisions, the basic rule is one of deference. LUBA, following precedent established by the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, largely defers on those kind of issues. If the primary issue is one of statutory interpretation, LUBA follows the well-established method to try to discern the intent of the legislature. And it looks at the text and the context of the statute, and if necessary, legislative history to try to discern that intent. LUBA publishes its opinions to provide a body of land use law, and it publishes those opinions in four ways. We have a website that contains about 10 years' worth of LUBA opinions. We publish those every week so that people with access to the Internet can access those in a timely fashion. We have a slip opinion subscription service. We send out paper copies to various subscribers. We bind and publish opinions into a book along with various research tools, and those are sold to various subscribers. And finally, through a contractual relationship with Westlaw, LUBA opinions are available for a price on a CD-ROM that's published by Westlaw. The LUBA's review procedure is intended to be as expeditious as possible. Under statute, LUBA is required to issue a final opinion in its review within 77 of the days of the day the record is settled with LUBA. And LUBA complied with that fairly well into the mid-90s. The annual number of appeals from 1979 through the early 1990s was about 100-120, for reasons that no one really understands. The number of appeals in the early 90s doubled, about 260-270. And as a result of that, the expansion of the caseload and unfortunately time turnover on the board, a large backlog developed in our cases. Instead of issuing opinions within 77 days, it was taking 6, 8, 9, sometimes over a year to get an opinion through LUBA. It was a matter of great distress. There also developed a large backlog in our publications. Instead of being published within a few months of being issued, some opinions took more than 2 years to be published. The legislature responded by granting LUBA two additional positions, a staff attorney and a publications coordinator, and with their help, LUBA has eliminated the publications backlog and will eliminate the case backlog this year. It's now down to, we're still not meeting the 77-day deadline for about half of our cases, but instead of being due 6, 8, 9 months, we're overdue about 4 to 6 weeks. And there's a graph that represents, shifting gears a little bit, that represents local land use permit steps that could happen. The graph that's depicted here shows sort of a full-blown hearing process. Someone's estimated that there are about 10,000 land use decisions in Oregon. Most of them are done administratively, a very simplified process that has only one or two steps to it. Only if a party requests a hearing is there a full-blown evidentiary hearing with all the bells and whistles that the statute provides for. The general rule is that the local government has to issue a final decision on a permit within 120 days of the day the application becomes final. Once it issues a final land use decision, then parties to that decision can appeal to LUBA within 21 days of the day it becomes final. And on Appendix B, there's an overview of the process for LUBA. And as you can see, it's very, very streamlined. Essentially, there are very strict deadlines that are set forth by the statute and by LUBA's rules. And after the record is filed, the parties have 21 days to submit the petition for review, and 21 days after that for the response briefs. And then LUBA has approximately 5 weeks thereafter to conduct oral argument and to issue its final opinion. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be glad to try to answer any questions I can.
I have a couple of questions. It appears that you have seven people within the agency.
Currently.
And what's your position? Are you one of the administrative support people? Or?
No, ma'am. I'm the board chair of LUBA, so I'm one of the three board members.
So you're part of the three-person board that actually hears the appeals cases.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And can you also tell me right now, you gave information here about the problems that you went through with the members turning over on the board and getting behind in the appeals. And you said that right now you're managing to stay within the time frames that are set for you. How many cases do you have right now that are awaiting hearing?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure which one to answer this last question first or both of them. I'll give you some background. In 1995, there was a complete turnover of the board. Three members left, and three new members came on. At that time, the appeal volume had doubled, and the old board wasn't keeping up with it, and the new board, because they were inexperienced, fell behind a great deal. So that was, there's no hard figures on it, but the time to get a Lupus, issuance of Lupus final opinion stretched to 6, 8, 9 months past the time that the record was settled, as opposed to 77 days. And I'm sorry, I forgot the second part of your question.
How many cases at the present time you have in your caseload?
Right now, we received 269 appeals last year, and about 60 of those were last-minute Measure 7 appeals. That's a record volume. Our average is about 240 per year of the last 6 or 7 years. At any given time, perhaps 100, 130 or so are active cases. So at any given time, any given day, we have about 130 active cases. And those are at various points in the pipeline. You can imagine the process is sort of a pipeline. And cases come in the pipeline, opinions go out the other end. There's a couple of points where the pipeline kind of narrows down. One of those is the oral argument. We can only conduct so many oral arguments in a given period of time. Our attempt now is to conduct about between 2 or 3 oral arguments per week. If we do more than that, then we get more opinions than we can issue. The second constriction is, of course, writing the final opinion. We have a short time under the statute to do so after oral argument, usually about 3 weeks. And if you have more than, say, about 9 or 10 cases in that category waiting for an opinion to issue, it's very difficult to write 9 or 10 opinions within 3 weeks.
How do you, from an administrative point of view, is there one of the hearings officers that writes all the opinions, or do you share it out amongst all three, and do you have a concurrence process? How does that part of it work?
Madam Chair, yes, all three of us have equal authority on the board, and we each write opinions. We each have a caseload that we manage. We all help each other with it as much as possible. If one person falls behind, the other ones leap into it. We have a board chair that does the administrative work for the agency. We don't have an office manager or agency manager. So in addition to the work I do as a board member writing opinions, I also have to do the administrative work of personnel and writing budgets and so forth. The only difference really is that the board chair has authority under the statute to assign cases to the other board members. I hope that answers your question.
I don't want to hog all the questions. Have you done
it? Yeah, just a logistical thing. Because Luba's opinions basically become kind of a body of law, I'm wondering, number one, how many cases go beyond you to the Court of Appeals? And number two, how much does the body of law you put down weigh into how the Court of Appeals addresses the issues, or do they bypass that and just go to statute and develop their own opinion based on statute?
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, approximately the last figures I know of for appeals to the Court of Appeals from Luba are from 1998, and that year we had 44 appeals. Putting a certain context, there's about 10,000 land use decisions that are made per year. About 260 of those go to Luba, and then about 44 Luba decisions go to the Court of Appeals. 1998, and of course, the Court of Appeals decision can be appealed to the Supreme Court. And that year, there were no Supreme Court appeals from the Court of Appeals. As to the relationship between the Court of Appeals and Luba, the Court of Appeals, of course, owes no deference to Luba decisions. They have, as set forth by the statute, a standard of review of how they review Luba decisions. And I don't think they have a restrict themselves necessarily to a particular area, for example, reviewing the statutes. If an argument is made to them by the parties that Luba made an error in resolving an evidentiary dispute, for example, they would review that.
Okay. Yes, would I be correct in assuming, percentage-wise, in 98th the year you're working off of, how many of the appeals, and how many of the appeals was Luba upheld, and how many were they overturned?
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, we have a performance measure for Court of Appeals review of Luba decisions, and our performance measure is 80% affirmed. And in the last, as far back as I'm aware of, we've always met that standard. Right now it's currently running about 90%, I believe.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm struck by this rather magnanimous, if I can use that term, provision in the statute that the plaintiffs do not have to be represented by attorneys, and that you all have made provisions that they are well taken care of without attorneys. And then subsequently, I'm hearing all of this potential appeal to the Court of Appeals, and it strikes me that without attorneys or without an attorney, an individual may be, in spite of the best intentions, at some significant disadvantage in this process. Would you comment on that, please?
Certainly, Madam Chair, Representative Jensen. It is true. I think if you're a party or participant for Luba and you choose to represent yourself, you take the risk of not doing a good job representing yourself, I guess. The land use law is complex. We try to make the process for appealing with Luba as simple as possible. That's about all we can do. The land use law itself is not up to us. It's set forth by the legislature and by LCDC, and that has become quite complex. And for someone who doesn't know much about land use law, to wade through that is a daunting prospect. We do our best to help them, but it's a difficult road to hoe.
Thank you, Perry. In the X number of cases, 240 or whatever the particular year might yield, who is the, what's the, these cases may come from basically one of two sources, either the landowner or LCDC, is that correct?
Madam Chair,
or the county?
They come from all walks. Often it will be the applicant or the landowner who perhaps the local government denied his application or imposed a condition that he doesn't like. It could be a neighbor group that doesn't like that particular development. It could be a group such as some of the land use watch groups that are out there. It could be DLCD. They don't appeal very many, but they do appeal some. We've even had appeals by business competitors, someone who wants to keep his business competition down, so he files a land use appeal of an application.
Representative King.
You said you have a 80% standard. Is that just your own criteria that you're judging yourself whether you're doing a good job or sub-performance, or was 80%, you know, some kind of average that you were referring to? Because you went on to say that your current rate was 90%.
Madam Chair, Representative King, the performance measures were set up, I think, in the early 80s. There was a requirement that all state agencies set up performance measures to gauge their performance. I'm not sure what went into arriving at that 80% figure. It may have been the board at that time thought that was doing pretty good. And the criteria, I believe, is affirmance. The Court of Appeals has to affirm our decision in order to meet the criteria. I hope that answers your question.
So, if for some reason you fall below 80%, then your board would go back and do some self-review to see what are you doing right, what are you doing wrong, your choices.
Madam Chair, Representative King, in an individual case, if the appeals remands a decision to us, of course we'll follow the mandate, and it may be we'll have to make a new decision based upon what their opinion says. It may be as a result of their remand we'll have to turn around and send it back to the local government. It just depends upon the facts of that case. If the performance measure was not met over an extended period of time, and we were consistently being overruled by the Court of Appeals, I think there would be some review on our part to figure out why we were getting it wrong. That has happened, so I'm not sure how we would do that, but I think that would definitely happen.
And then you mentioned your 90% current rate. Was that lifetime or year 2000 or a five-year rolling average? What were you giving us there?
Madam Chair, Richmond King. It's my recollection from the last quarter of the biennium. We do performance measures on a quarterly basis and send in the results, I believe, to the DAC. And there's some for the entire biennium. So I think the basic unit is biennium by biennium with quarterly results each time. My recollection is from the last quarter was 100%, but the average for the biennium was, I think, 90%. That was my recollection.
Which biennium are you referring to?
The current one, 9901.
Thank you.
Good question. Thank you very much for coming down to talk to us today. I appreciate you taking the time, and I'm sure that as issues are brought before the committee in bill form, that we'll be seeing more of you.
Okay, yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could I just make the comment on the question I had in relationship that I don't think it, you know, to attorneys and the needs thereof. It does kind of constantly bother me that the citizens of the state are put at disadvantage when they maybe don't have the means, resources, or choose to have attorneys. I don't know that there's an answer. I don't know that I'm proposing an answer, but I must admit that I'm constantly bothered by the actions that we take that put people at a disadvantage if they do not have or do not take the option of having legal representation or some other professional representation, whether that be legal or, you know, scientific or what have you.
I think that's an excellent point, Representative Jensen, that we need to be really careful that we don't put access to the court system and to these kinds of systems to people that are not economically able to continue that process at a disadvantage in them, and that's something that we've talked a lot about.
Well, yeah, I guess, Madam Chair, some of that's our fault because we made the darn law so complicated.
Yeah.
Representative Lee.
Yes, Madam Chairman, I'm thinking that from what I recall that we purposefully made it accessible to people at a lower price without an attorney, and since a quarter of the people are in that position, maybe they can't afford legal counsel, but they still like to have an opportunity, so it's difficult to weigh where that balance should really be. Given that so many people are going without an attorney, it may close the door to a lot of folks who at least can participate to some level.
Representative King?
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think also that LUBA was created, you know, as a lower price option than what a full court proceeding, you know, would be otherwise. I think we need to keep that in mind.
Representative Jensen?
I appreciate this, and I do appreciate the fact that that the board, you know, makes an effort to help people walk their way through. And I think Representative Cruz's point is well taken, that we are to blame, and not blaming the board. We made the laws. And that may be a kind of catch-22. How do you do this without making them complicated? I'm not sure, Representative. But it still bothers me.
Well, I kind of would take exception to that, because I think that what really complicates the situation are the administrative rules that are written to implement some of the laws that we have. And I also take exception to LUBA essentially writing law or writing rule by the decisions that they make, too. And so I think that that's a whole other ball of wax or can of worms that we probably are not going to be well served to get into at this point.
Yeah.
But the land use planning system is becoming incredibly complicated and expensive, and it takes people a long time to get out the other end of it. And we've, all of us, I think, in our legislative experiences, have dealt with many of those situations.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. One more comment, and I agree with everything you said, and you could have, we could have, and I don't think we will, reference a LUBA decision affecting Douglas County that basically goes against common sense land use in Douglas County. but I will say that quite often the legislature tends to draft legislation that leaves too darn many holes for administrative rules to be written. My hope is that in this committee specifically, as we attempt to deal with the impacts of Measure 7, might be able to put in place some things that give us some more reasonable processes for dealing with land use decisions.
Thank you very much. Next on the agenda, we have Paul Cleary, who is the director of the Oregon Water Resources Department. Good morning, Paul.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Cleary, director of the Oregon Water Resources Department. We're the people who like rain and like snow. Unfortunately, we're not getting as much of it as we'd like right now.
I'm telling you, I got some this weekend.
Well, that's good to hear. We've got a presentation on our responsibilities, authorities, how we're organized, and some basics on Oregon water law. But I thought I'd take a little bit of time just to set the context in terms of the resource. We've got a fact sheet here. Oregon has got a tremendous water resource legacy. We've got close to 115,000 miles of rivers and streams, some 6,000 lakes and reservoirs. Normal year annual precipitation ranging from 200 inches in a coast range to about 5 inches in the Steens Mountain shadow. Normally we'll see snow depths of over 20 feet throughout the Cascades. Our rivers carry about 66 million acre feet annually, which if it were all stored would cover the entire state more than a foot deep. We've got about 61 million acres in Oregon. About 55 million of that comes on the west side, 11 million on the east side. In terms of users, we withdraw 8 to 10 million acre feet annually, about 15% of total flows. We've got some 50,000 surface water rights with 125,000 diversions, over 160 years history of water withdrawals. Starting, I believe, back in 1836 with a water-powered sawmill near Shampooey. We've got about 16,000 groundwater rights with 200,000 wells, 14,000 reservoir rights ranging from 1.1 million acre feet in the Owyhee Reservoir to over 16,000 small reservoirs, less than 9.2 acre feet. Irrigation is our primary use of withdrawn water. They hold about 67% of the surface water rights, use about 77% of the water, hold about 85% of groundwater rights, and use 84% of water withdrawals. Over half of Oregon's farms and ranches have irrigated lands, with about 1.6 million acres irrigated statewide. We've got some 3,500 public water supply systems serving 80% of the population. Hydropower provides 50% of the state's electric consumption. We've got about an average of about 5,000 plus megawatt power potential. Two of the biggest hydropower projects in the nation are located in Oregon. John Day Dam is ranked third, and the Dalles 6th in terms of power production. Substantial navigation and in-stream uses. We've got some 1,500 in-stream water rights, over 50 wild and scenic river segments, substantial amount of water-related hunting, fishing, general recreation, major waterborne traffic and ports, and then 12 salmon and steelhead listings in terms of some of the populations of threatened and endangered species in the state. Give you an idea of flows that maybe you can relate to here in Salem. The Willamette, during an average year, is flowing some 50,000 cubic feet this time of year. At the beginning of the month, we were only flowing about 18,000 cubic feet. During the floods of February 1996, we were flowing around 240,000 cubic feet per second. The Mill Creek Canal right here by the Ram, on average, is about 50 cubic feet. That's a pretty controlled structure. To give you some ideas when we start talking different volumes. And with that, Madam Chair, I might turn it over to Tom Beiler, our legislative coordinator, to walk through the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can folks hear me okay on this microphone? For the record, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Beiler. I'm the Senior Policy Coordinator at the Water Resources Department. I'll be acting as the legislative point person during the session. If you ever have any questions or informational needs with the department, don't hesitate to contact me. I'm going to hopefully not have a breakdown on this system here. These things make me very nervous. We've got a PowerPoint presentation. We've got a lot of slides today. And I'm going to try to whip through them fairly quickly in the interest of time. I know you have two other presentations after ours, but I will encourage you to ask any questions along the way, and we'll just get started then. We're the Water Resources Department. We deal with water quantity issues. We don't deal with water quality issues directly. That's the Department of Environmental Quality that has that responsibility. Our commission and department some years ago developed a mission statement to serve the public by practicing and promoting wise long-term water management. There are two co-equal goals that kind of set our focus toward that mission. That is of supply and stewardship. In supply, of course, the goal here is to make sure that we have adequate water supplies to meet the present and future needs of the state. And stewardship is to ensure that as we develop the resource, we do it in a way that protects stream flow values and in-stream needs that the state is finding of increasing importance. We have five core management strategies that help us set our goals in terms of implementing our mission. Again, the stewardship and supply are our two primary goals, but managed information is becoming a very, very important aspect of helping the public in understanding the water resources around the state. Of course, citizen services is a primary function, and funding opportunities is becoming obviously important. Very few things can happen without some money to help them move forward. Briefly, I want to describe a little bit about our commission and department structure. We have a 7-member citizen board, the Water Resources Commission. They're volunteers. They represent 5 different regions of the state, and we have 2 at-large, east side and west side, members of our board. They're appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, and serve 4-year terms. Our commission help us strategically in setting our policy. Of course, within the framework that is set out by the statute that the legislature develops, but our commission helps us resolve appeals regarding contested cases, exceptions to contested cases. They also help us by approving our administrative rules.
Madam Chair, just one question. Your board members serve at the pleasure of the governor or 4-year terms?
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, it's 4-year terms at the pleasure of the governor.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, the Water Resources Department is split into 5 different divisions. We have approximately 150 staff, so we're a fairly small agency in the scope of the state picture. All of our different divisions are under the director and our deputy director. Our divisions are divided into a technical services division, which really is our information management team. They are the ones who study surface water and groundwater, do a lot of data analysis for folks, and are the kind of the traditional role of the Water Resources Department in terms of engineering skills. We have a Water Rights and Adjudications Division. They handle our water right application and certificate review. They also oversee our adjudication process and our hydroelectric activities. Field services, this division has our water masters. They deal with a wide range of activities, including conservation activities, supply planning, transfers, and just the day-to-day work in working with the water user community. Administrative services are our internal shopkeepers, basically help us with our financial management and human resource issues. And the director's office, which focuses on policy, works most directly with the commission and dealing with tribal negotiations and other matters.
Can you give us, in that last slide, just some kind of quick and dirty numbers about how many people that you have in each of those areas?
I'll go back to the, Madam Chair, the previous slide. I failed to point out that on the right-hand column, we have our current staffing levels in the different divisions of our agency.
Thank you.
While our central office is here in Salem, our offices are spread out throughout the state. We have five main regions with a head regional office, and we have 20 district offices where our water masters are located. This slide shows you the locations of all of these water master offices and the regional offices. It's a lot of work for our regional staff. We have over 80,000 water rights, surface water rights, as many as 200,000 plus wells, domestic and monitoring wells. It's a lot of work for our folks out in the field to keep track of all these things. Next, I'd like to segue into a discussion about Oregon water law. This is Western water law is based on the doctrine of prior appropriation. It's really a 19th century principle developed in the mid to late 1800s. Which provided a mechanism for use of water in the western states. Our code is based on that doctrine, and it's helpful to understand the basics of this doctrine in order to kind of have a foundation for discussion of some legislative issues that may occur during the session. In 1909, when the legislature adopted the code, it declared that all waters of the state, surface water and groundwater, are a public resource. Water rights are basically an authorization to use that public resource. So a water right is a property right, but it's a slightly different property right than what folks traditionally consider property rights to be. It is a water right to a water right is a right to use the public resource.
Madam Chair.
Yes. We talk about public resource. What is the public? Are we talking the state? Are we talking the nation?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, we're talking the state. And by the state, I mean the citizens of the state. And the Water Resources Department is merely out there to manage the resource on behalf of the citizens.
How is it then that the Environmental Protection Agency and others consistently refer to it as our water, that is the agency, the federal agency's water?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, we find that a lot of water user community often consider water to be theirs once they have a water right, and in fact, if they do have a water right, they do have that water in the sense of that they have a right to use it, but ultimately the water is the state's water if it originates within the state boundaries.
Madam Chair?
Please.
Well, I think we have, you know, it does strike me that we've got, when we talk of the difference between the state and federal government, a real fundamental problem here.
in definition. And when we start looking at trying to adopt policy for the state, if we don't have a definition of whose water it is, it's difficult to adopt that policy. And I appreciate, you know, that it is your definition. My problem is with the other people who don't appreciate that it is our water, Oregon's water.
Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Traditionally, water that never left somebody's property was kind of considered to be theirs. Is that no longer true, and is part of the reason that is no longer true based on relationship that's still somewhat in the theory stage of the relationship between ground and surface water?
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, I think what you'd be speaking about are springs that rise on property and don't flow off naturally,
right,
because the terrain's been manipulated in any way to capture that spring flow. And the use of that water is exempt from a requirement for permit.
Okay, right. To follow up, Madam Chair?
It would still be considered, it's exempt from the requirement for a permit, it would still be considered public waters.
Okay, but my point, I guess, is as we are trying to flesh out and develop groundwater policy, the relationship between ground and surface water, I guess I could see a point in time where some might challenge the sovereignty over that source simply because it is groundwater initially.
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, always possible. I'm not aware that there's been any challenge to how we've dealt with it in the past.
Okay.
Committee members, we're under kind of a tight time constraint here, and I think that most of the people that we have appearing before us today wanted to talk more about process than content. So if we have to keep our content questions to a minimum, we would get through this agenda. Please proceed.
Well, Madam Chair, I'll try to step on the accelerator here a little bit myself. Well, there are four areas. Again, you guys can hear me, but four areas in the water code that I want to focus on very briefly. One part, critical and fundamental part of using water is to use it for beneficial use. Everyone who holds a water right is, the basic premise is that they're making beneficial use of the water. That is a wide-ranging, ever-evolving category. Traditionally, irrigation, industrial, domestic, municipal uses were the primary types of uses. More recently, in the scope of water law, in-stream water rights have been a major category of use. Prior appropriation doctrine, major principle, first in time, first in right. This is a critical area of water law and understanding that the more senior your water right, when we talk about seniority, we talk about the priority date of the water right, the more secure the opportunity that you'll be able to use that water in times of low flow. This slide illustrates how the priority system works. We have a stream that's flowing towards us. Upstream, you have a 1970 junior water right. Downstream, a 1910 senior water right. In times of low flow, the senior can contact the water master if they're not receiving all the water that they are entitled to under their right due to the low flow conditions, and contact the water master to shut off the 1970 junior user in order for them, the senior, to receive the water that they're entitled to under their right. So obviously, the more senior the right, the better off the water user is.
We had a kind of an ongoing discussion with the National Marine Fisheries Service over the interim with the implementation of their 4D rule, and the previous director was very concerned that the way that the National Marine Fisheries Service wanted to implement the 4D rule was really contrary to the priority aspects of Oregon water right. Can you real quickly update the committee on where that discussion is?
Madam Chair, we've had a task force consisting of various interest groups and three members of our commission that have been working on this overlay between the Endangered Species Act in Oregon water law. We've got several bills that will be debated and discussed during this session to add some additional tools to our toolbox to help folks. And we're also working with the National Marine Fisheries Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on a memorandum of agreement to deal with how they will implement various actions under the Endangered Species Act. They basically, have got some different requirements in terms of consultation and enforcement, and, we're looking for ways to restore stream flows and minimize disruptions, and ideally managing within a priority system is the best way to go. We're not there yet, but we're hopeful.
Thank you.
Third major point of the 1909 Water Code is the idea of appurtenancy. This basically means that a water right is attached to the property where it is used. This is a fundamental principle, and it would function in the sense that if a landowner with a water right moves to a different area of the state, they can't take that water right with them. The water right actually stays with the property, and the person who purchases that property would then hold the water right. Is also an important principle in terms of our management purposes. By having that water being attached to a property, it makes it a more easy, easier for our water master to know whether water is being used or not, basically. And the final element here is that water must be used. The idea of issuing a water right to a user is with the understanding that the water user is going to make use of that water and not just sit on that water for speculative purposes. This is, a very fundamental principle of the code, and once one has a water right, there is an obligation to continue using that water if they want to retain the water right. If water goes unused for a 5 consecutive year period, it may be subject to cancellation. There are a lot of exceptions to that, that rule. Or that statute, that is. But nevertheless, the principle remains that folks are supposed to use the water when they obtain a water right. Terms and conditions of a water right are becoming increasingly important as the resource becomes more scarce and we have more resource concerns due to clean water or the Endangered Species Act. Water rights are limited to a certain rate and duty. That is, the amount of water they can pull out of the stream or the amount of water they can apply to the land, and the times of use, irrigation use in particular, usually has a season of use, and there may be measurement conditions and other types of conditions placed on the water right.
Madam Chair, very quickly, I have a parcel of land, it has a water right. My land use decision is to put a peach orchard on it. That will have a life of 15 to 20 years, and then it will revert back to previous use. What would I mean, and for me to every 5 years go and water that peach orchard when it doesn't need it is kind of a wasteful practice. What procedure or application would I have to, what would I have to do to protect that water right and not be uselessly using the water?
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, one of the tools that we've got that a lot of people use is lease the water in stream during that time period, and that kind of meets two goals, prevents it from being forfeited and helps us in terms of stream flow restoration.
Okay, thank you.
Some terms of the trade here, point of diversion. When we talk about point of diversion, we're talking about surface water. That's the point where we withdraw water from the source. Point of appropriation is what we talk about when we talk about a well. Place of use, that's where the water is applied, and the type of use is the beneficial use which the water puts. While we often talk about water rights, there are types of uses of both groundwater and surface water that don't require water rights. These tend to be small, de minimis uses, including for groundwater, they include single and domestic wells, small commercial and industrial uses, and up to a half acre of lawn and garden use. The surface water exempt uses include livestock watering, emergency firefighting, and certain land management practices. The permit system, I'm going to try to work through this pretty quickly, but what I wanted to emphasize here is that when we talk about a water right, we could be talking about a couple of different things. When one applies for water rights, they get a water right permit, and that is the initial permission to develop the water right, to build the delivery system, and put the water to beneficial use as contemplated under the right. Through that period of development, we call that proving up, and after a certain time frame that's allowed in statute, they have an opportunity to offer their final proof that the survey map quantifies the extent to which they developed the water right, and they submit that to the Water Resources Department, and then they're able to receive a water right certificate. This is the final vested water right, and it's the most secure form of the water right, and provides some more flexibility in terms of what one can do with a water right, because it is a water use that is called subject to transfer. The transfer process allows folks to make changes to the water right, whether it's the point of diversion, the place of use, or even the type of use. In-stream water rights. We talk about the 1909 code. Water was being used long, long before that. We're aware of water uses that may be as early as 1840s, 1850s across the state. It wasn't until 1955 that the state legislature recognized the value of in-stream flows by creating a statute authorizing minimum perennial stream flows. It wasn't until 1987 that the legislature designated an equal status to in-stream flows by creating the In-Stream Water Rights Act. And we now have in-stream water rights, which function just like any other water right. They're subject to the priority system. One of the disadvantages that the in-stream water rights have at this point is that they were developed much later in time than many of the out-of-stream uses. Describe the in-stream program here. Three agencies, Parks, DEQ, and Fish and Wildlife, may apply for in-stream water rights for different purposes. In-stream water rights also can be obtained through lease or transfer or gift. Briefly, I want to talk a little bit about the functions of our agency. Studying the resource, hydrographics, measuring stream flows. This is a very important area for us. Understanding what flow levels are gives us the ability to refine our water availability analysis. It gives us some indication of potential flood events. It also gives us a head start on some knowing whether drought events may be occurring. There are approximately 200 gauging stations, stream flow gauging stations statewide. Most of these are joint ventures with the United States Geological Survey or other entities. These stations basically allow us to measure and monitor stream flows. Distinguishing between measurement of withdrawals for water users. This information that we collect is meaningless unless we bring it into the Water Resources Department and manage that and organize that information so that it becomes useful. And we have several different systems that allow us to organize that information, either pertaining to water rights, pertaining to water availability for potential new uses, and pertaining to the groundwater resource. This information is very important for the water user community to help them understand what options they have available to them. Water availability. The map you see here. It indicates water availability, that is, water available for new appropriation, I think in the month of September. That tan area, or yellowish-brown area, is where water is not available that month. And it's obviously a pretty bleak scenario. This is surface water, by the way. The other colored areas show where there is some water available, and what you see is mainly the main stem of the Willamette and maybe the Mackenzie there and some mountainous areas and a few areas on the coast. The water availability model that we use is premised on the idea of trying to provide as much certainty to new users as possible. And the way we gauge it is that we will issue water rights if we can show that through this model that 80% of the time, that is 8 out of every 10 years, the water right holder is going to probably see water available for their use. This is important to realize, considering the substantial investments that water users make in terms of the infrastructure that they have to build. We want to make sure that there's some certainty that they're going to have water to use when they get their water right. This water availability model is fairly recent in our history. Some of the eastern basins did not have that kind of structure, and as a result, we have a number of basins that are over-appropriated, and some of those water users on those reaches don't see their water very regularly.
This is one of the areas that I think would be a good thing for the new members of the committee to get some education in, because the whole process here is very sophisticated, and there is a lot of aspects to it, like return flows and in-stream water rights, that make it much more complicated than it appears at first blush.
Geographical information systems, water rights mapping, basically data regarding the resource. It's important for us as a managing agency. It's also important for the water user community. Mapping systems. Here we have a map showing some proposed gauging stations. We're moving in new directions in terms of our sophistication in water rights mapping, and we're making that available over the internet. And it's a pretty exciting new area for us. So I think it's going to be very helpful to the water user community. Groundwater. We have a number of groundwater studies throughout the state. This is the, as it says here, the unseen resource. Obviously, that's true, and that creates some problems. We don't know as much about what goes on with groundwater. We can't know as much about groundwater as we can with surface water. Surface water, obviously, you can just go out to the stream and take a look and see what's going on there. Not as easy for groundwater. We have been studying a few areas to get a better understanding of how the groundwater, what is involved with the groundwater resource. The Deschutes Basin, we have a recently completed study there. Learn a lot more about the dynamic between the surface water and the groundwater. We have some proposed study areas that's in the kind of the purple area. And we have some management areas where we have learned that through overuse that the groundwater table is in jeopardy of declining. And when we discover that that's a situation, we have ability to declare a management area for these places and restrict, make restrictions on new uses in order to protect the existing folks until that resource can rehabilitate itself. Implementing the laws. Water rights. I've talked a little bit about water rights. There are other types of water use authorizations you should be aware of. Limited licenses, for one, which is a water use authorization for short-term, fixed duration types of uses, much like road watering, that ODOT may need to use water during the summertime on one specific area in the state. They'll never need to use the water there again. A limited license may give them the ability to use water for that purpose. Adjudication. This is how we author or finalize the water uses that occurred prior to the 1909 Water Code. As I mentioned, some of these uses are very old. This map here shows the adjudicated areas in the state. You can see this is surface water only. You can see the east side has been adjudicated to a great extent. We have an adjudication that's ongoing now in the Klamath Basin. A lot of you are probably familiar with it. We've been working on it for 30-plus years, and roughly 30 years. It's and that's not necessarily a long-lived adjudication, depending on where you go. Other states deal with adjudications, and there are some that are out there that have been ongoing for 40 years or more. Complicated matter. It underscores how important those early water rights are, because you often find with these adjudications that there are a lot of legal battles, a lot of legal skirmishes along the way to try to sort out who owns the water and to what extent they hold that water. In a nutshell, an adjudication is a process that combines kind of a quasi-judicial review by the Water Resources Department to quantify the claims in that, in a particular basin for those pre-1909 uses. We make a determination, an order that's issued and sent to the local court. The court then will issue a decree based on that determination. There's ability for contest and appeal throughout that process. Right now in the Klamath, we are in the process of we send out our preliminary findings and are undergoing a number of contests to our preliminary findings. When those contests are resolved, we will be, then be in a position to issue our final determination, which then basically passes the baton to the court where they can start working on issuing their final, the final decree on these rights. Resolving disputes, the emphasis here is that we try to work out things before we go to contest the case. We try to work out things so that we don't have to go to court. It's in everyone's best interest to try to resolve issues through negotiated settlement. We have been very, very successful in the water rights application arena in resolving disputes without lengthy contested case and expensive contested case hearings and judicial actions. We have, it's been a great success in terms of our program area. Hydro relicensing, the Water Resources Department is responsible for issuing licenses for the use of water as they relate to hydro projects. This may be an issue of interest given the power issues that have come up on the West in recent weeks. Our role here has less to do with the power than it does to do with the water use, but obviously there's a relation there. We are involved with the Department of Environmental Quality and the Department of Fish and Wildlife in reviewing state projects, that is, projects that have no federal oversight, and projects that have joint federal and state oversight. We don't have any jurisdiction over the Main Stem Columbia projects, but we do have around 160 projects that we oversee, and some of them are fairly significant size. Managing the resource, enforcement, very important area. When we talk about enforcement and natural resources, that often raises the hackles of many people. They don't like the resource to be see any kind of distribution or enforcement regarding natural resources. With water, it's a kind of a strange mixture, because every time we enforce it against a junior, we're helping a senior water right holder. So we may not be making someone very happy, but we're probably, by that action, actually helping someone else out. Oregon Plan, we're involved with the Oregon Plan like the other natural resource agencies. We have a number of measures that we are implementing on behalf of the Oregon Plan. We do education and outreach. It's part of our strategic planning as we look to the future, and we work actively and routinely with our sister agencies in coordinating the efforts. Briefly, the Willamette Basin has a number of federal reservoirs. We're working with the Corps of Engineers, Army Corps of Engineers, on a study of these reservoirs. They're up for reauthorization for their uses. Uses historically have been for flood control, primarily for flood control, recreation, and I think probably another major use is irrigation. And through the reauthorization, the federal reauthorization process, they will be taking a hard look at whether those uses should be changed for any reason. And we're involved in a study that will hopefully provide some input toward that process. About 1,300 dams that we oversee for dam safety concerns. We inspect them. Obviously, this is an important function for the department. They can provide significant risk to public safety and health if they were to fail. Conservation and management. We do work with municipalities, irrigation districts, to help them develop conservation plans and management plans for their water, organizing, kind of help them organize themselves so that they understand what options they have available to them, so they do long-term supply planning, so that they have available to them a curtailment plan so that they're ready in times of drought, and also to work on conservation measures. We work with folks in terms of giving them technical advice for their supply planning, storage. And our water masters, I've talked about them. They are the frontline folks, do very important work for us. This is the last slide, and I'll leave this for you. You'll have it in your handouts. We've talked about a number of these things, and I think I'll, unless there are any questions, I'll sign off and let you get moving forward with your hearing.
Representative Lee.
I'd just like to request there are two or three colored maps, like the adjudication map. Would it be possible you could get us copies of those?
I just want to say, first of all, that after seeing several agency overviews and a couple of committees, this is one of the best, and so my hat is off to you. And I made a good point on some of the newer members studying up on particularly in some of the in-stream flows. And what I was going to do is just listen to whatever Representative Lee tells me. Issues. I did have one question I was just curious about. Under whose jurisdiction is the Columbia River Basin and those water right issues?
Madam Chair, Representative Haas, any water use in Oregon is under Oregon's jurisdiction. Water use in Washington, it varies by the four states. I've often asked myself, how do we identify those molecules as they come down, because they all get mixed. But most of our uses are on the tributaries. We do have some major pumping projects out of the main stem up in Representative Jensen's and northeast Oregon. But we don't have an interstate compact on the Columbia like you'll see in a lot of other regions, primarily because it never got to the point where the states were fighting with each other like they did in my old territory in Wyoming, where we had a lawsuit between Wyoming and Nebraska that went on for about 15 years, and both states spent around $21 million. I think the legislature thought that when we were going in asking for money, we were talking about the football game, and they just pushing money into it. But it was Wyoming v. Nebraska was the name of the lawsuit. But thank God we haven't gotten to that point.
Representative Jensen.
Specifically, I think for that reason, Representative Cleary, just a comment, not a question, that the acronym for the data analysis management is appropriate WARS.
WARS.
Yeah. Paul, but we do have a restriction on the amount of Columbia River water that can be taken for agricultural purposes. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, we've got rules that control our issuance of water rights in the Columbia River, and basically what we're looking at is there's got to be a net benefit to fish, or we do these exchange projects such as the Umatilla project, and then you run, of course, into the National Marine Fishery Service with the listed species there. Anytime there's a consultation requirement, which if you stick a straw in the river, you're going to be in a consultation requirement, you're going to run up against that.
I guess it's all, what's really bothered me about that is that Washington doesn't necessarily put similar restrictions on ag water taken from the Columbia. When you look at the amount of ag water we take out of the Columbia, it's 0.7% of the flow of the river. So I'm, I have a really hard time finding impact out of 0.7% of the flow.
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, I do know right now since 1994, they've had restrictions on new water rights out of the Columbia as
they have,
well.
But they're way above.
Yeah, yeah. I think they're around 40%. They use a lot of it up in the central part of the state.
Representative Jensen, we need to move on.
Yes, I know. But very quickly, I think for the purposes of this committee, it would be beneficial if you would provide us with the, since the topic has come up, with the figures on the amount of flow or the amount of water taken from the Columbia for irrigation in Oregon, contrasted with the amount of water taken for irrigation, et cetera, in Oregon. And we would, of course, suggest for you that there have been new developments in the Columbia River area since 1994, that there's a very distinct difference in the law in Washington versus the law in Oregon, and there have been tens of thousands of acres of grapes that have gone into irrigation since the 94 period, plus wheatland and other things. And I think I can take you and fly you over that area now and show you new projects in development.
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, probably similar to what we see where you get a water right years ago, in some cases decades ago, and are continuing to see the development. I do know there's a lawsuit going on in Washington right now because of Washington's refusal to issue new water rights, but I think you're probably right that there is development of previously issued water rights going on.
Thank you very much, Director Perry and Mr. Barter. This has been one of the best presentations that I've seen also, and I really commend you on your organization and the territory that you covered. The, those of us that have kind of dipped our toes into water resources issues in Oregon can appreciate the complexity. You've got the oldest body of law in the state, basically, with pieces that have been duct taped and baling wired all over it for more than 100 years, and it's extremely complex. And when you add in interjurisdictional issues on the Columbia River, the problems are very, very difficult to solve. It's very difficult even to get all the players to the table. The committee is extremely fortunate to have the expertise of Representative Lee on this side of the curving table, and we're looking forward to your input on these issues. And thank you very much for taking the time to talk to the committee today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We look at it as nothing but opportunities to excel.
Ooh, that was nice.
Moving right along here, we have John Ledger from Associated Oregon Industries.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Ledger with Associated Oregon Industries. Many of you know me from last session. I'm new to some of you. Associated Industries is the largest business association in the state. We have about 18,000 members. Our environment committee is about 300 members. Before we get into what I'm going to talk about, I just want to mention three bills that this committee passed last session that have really had a good payoff already. One of the, these were all AOI bills. One of them was a reauthorization of the DEQ Green Permits Program, came through this committee. And that Green Permits Program, which allows companies that excel environmentally to get some type of an administrative break, is now being copied by other states and EPA, used it as a model for the federal Green Permits Program. Another AOI bill came through this committee, Community Right to Know. The Eugene Community Right to Know program is still running fine, still up and going. And the bill that you did pass gave about $300,000 to the state fire marshal and the DEQ to improve their programs. And you will now be able to get into the state fire marshal's office to look at emission information by geographical area, by company, by, you'll be able to do horizontal searches by pollutant. And so that has been a huge improvement. And the last bill that came through last session that I think is now bearing fruit, and that allows the DEQ to have an appeals and conflict resolution process in their cleanup program. And that is, they've put that in place, and they've done an excellent job, by the way, doing that. So I think that's a big payoff. I'm here with Sandy Nusser, who's my assistant, who will be working our slides here. And it's a little out of focus, Sandy, I think. That's it? Okay. We should be able to get it in a little bit better focus than that. One of the things I want to touch on kind of which is where we are going and where we are. And this chart, I'll read it for you. This is exceedances of federal air quality standards in Oregon. And this is in the entire state for all air quality pollutants. And an exceedance, a horrible word, but an exceedance is a little different than a standard. A lot of standards, you have to pop the standard several times before it's an outdoor air quality violation. But every time you pop it, it's an exceedance. So that's the worst case plot we can do. And you can see back in 1985, we had close to 200 exceedances statewide a year. And with the Clean Air Act going into place, we dropped down about 1992 to about zero, and we've been bumping along the bottom since then. And this is a huge success story. And this is the result of a lot of people working together, DEQ, EPA, industries, people with wood stoves, automobile emission reductions. But this is a huge story. We've essentially gone to zero now since the Clean Air Act was in place. And if we could have the next one. The green plot is just a plot of population, and it's a compressed scale from 5 million up to around 3.4 million. And that's just to show you that the population can grow, and it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to degrade some aspect of the environment. Because while the emissions were going down, the population was going up. If we could see the next one. Now, this one actually is a little bit fuzzy because it comes right off of the EPA website, but this is the one of the reasons we see that improvement in the prior graph. This is a chart from EPA that shows emissions over time on nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, and volatile organic compounds. And VOCs are really any hydrocarbon. They contribute to smog and ozone formation. And you can see that in the last several years, we've been having pretty drastic reductions in those because of the Clean Air Act, and we're probably looking at about 1960 levels now as to where we were in 60. Next one's fine, Sandy. There's a similar trend going on in water through the Clean Water Act that requires improvements and reductions. This is right off of the DEQ. This is data right off of the DEQ website. The green bar is the percent of streams that are improving, and it's plotted by year. And you can see it goes from about 1990, where the percent of streams that were improving was only about 10%. And now the rate, the streams that are improving, probably about 70% of the streams are improving. And you can see the red line, which are the streams that are getting worse, goes from around 20% in 1990 that were getting worse, and now it's down to a very small percentage. It's probably about 2% are actually getting worse. And this is right off of the DEQ webpage. Okay, we can have the next one. I wanted to show you something. Again, this is a DEQ chart, and this is Oregon air pollution sources. Many of our members are industrial sources, and so, you know, this was a good one to put up. But what you see is in Oregon, transportation is about 57% of the air pollution in the state. 38 are what are called area sources, and that's houses, that's heating for this building, it's small commercial operations like body shops where you use solvents, just about anything that happens that is not an industrial facility. And then 5% of Oregon air pollution sources are from industrial sources. So they've been pretty, this is where we sit now. We've had pretty good controls. This pie, you know, the proportions may stay about the same, but what we want is for the whole pie to shrink. You know, get down everywhere. You can have the next one.
Representative King.
Mm-hmm. What category would road dust go for?
That'd be an area, that would be an area source. This, again, is a DEQ chart, sources of water pollution, and there's been a lot of, there are some huge regulations coming up on urban runoff because urban sources of water pollution have been essentially unregulated, and this is everything that runs off of our houses and our streets and freeways, whatever we put around my lawn. The industrial plus municipal segment of water pollution is around 15%, and DEQ feels it's about 50% industrial, and about 50, of that, about 50% is industrial, about 50% is municipal.
I'm sure.
Representative Cruz.
In this pie chart, they are including, I'm assuming, temperature as pollution.
On this, Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, I don't know on this one.
Okay, you know, that we're getting into the same old argument about point, non-point, and non-point is... okay. I'll save that discussion for later.
Thank you.
Representative King.
What does the olive one say? I can't tell.
Madam Chairman, pardon me. This
olive-colored piece of the pie, what's it say?
The olive color is non-point sources, and that is urban runoff, natural causes, everything other than industrial or municipal. Okay, Sandy. I wanted to talk a little bit about next steps, which is where we go from here. And you remember the first chart, which showed a pretty drastic reduction, you know, coming down around 1994 or so. The Clean Air Act is not a stagnant piece of legislation. It requires things to be done well into the future. And there'll be things that are getting done by the Clean Air Act in 2010, 2020. It keeps carrying forward. And one of the things the Clean Air Act is focusing on now, and you hear a lot of talk about, are air toxics, or hazardous air pollutants, sometimes they're called. And right now, this is where we sit. This is sources of EPA's 33 air toxics. EPA has 189 categories they look at. This 33 is what they call their worst. It's like the 33 worst. And this is the sources of their air toxics. And industrial is about 9%. Residential and commercial, which would include small businesses, but homes, heating is about 40%. 29% comes from cars and trucks, and 22%, and this is surprising, comes from what are called off-road engines. And that is things like lawnmowers and construction engines, things like that. You'd be amazed how much pollution a lawnmower puts out, about as much as 50 cars. It's a two-stroke engine. So this is what they're going to focus on kind of from here on out. Okay, Sandy. Okay, this one is a little bit harder to read. This pertains only to that 9% industrial segment. But what is happening now is on the bottom we have years going from 91 to 2009. Maximum achievable control technology reductions. These are affecting virtually every industry. And what they're doing is they go through all the industries, like pulp and paper, metals, you name it, making paint, everything you can think of, bakeries. And what they do is they apply standards that are going to have to be retrofitted. And the way they do that is they look nationally and they say, they look at the top 12% of the types of that facility, and then they make everybody else come up to that top 12%. Unless you're new, building a new one, in which case you have to build as good a one as exists anywhere. So what's happening is a lot of facilities now in the process of retrofitting. And that will go on for, the standards will keep coming out for about another year. And then the retrofitting, which will take years, is already ongoing. Some of these are kind of coupled with water reductions too. For instance, pulp and paper, they're doing the reductions in water and air at the same time. And they're pretty stringent. I did some calculations like dioxin. Everyone's talking about dioxin. The standard for dioxin is one part dioxin per 1.300 quadrillion parts of water, which when I did the calculations at home, and I think what it came out to be is about 400, one teaspoon of dioxin per 400 billion tons of water. So the standards are getting stricter as you go. But once all these standards are put in place,
is that standard measurable?
It is defined at, the standard is whatever the least you can measure is. So that's measurable, and when they get a better way to measure dioxin, the standard will drop. It's whatever is the minimum you can measure, that's the standard. And right now it's one teaspoon in about 400 billion.
How big a body of water would that be?
I don't know. I looked it up to see for lakes and things like that, and I couldn't find it. Yeah, we should know. Well, I came up, and I left it at home, but I think it was about one teaspoon in 400 billion tons of water. Yeah.
8 pounds of the gallon.
But at 8.345 pounds per gallon.
Okay, Palm Pilot size.
Yeah. It's a lot of water. I brought a teaspoon, you know, but yeah, I didn't bring the water. So once this all gets in place, which is federal and the state implements it and it rolls through, which is being done now, then there's another set of reductions and regulations that will roll through Oregon also, and the rest of the country. And that is, once the standards roll through, then EPA will go and look and do what's called residual risk. They'll look and they'll say, okay, you put on this retrofit, you put all these standards in place, now we're going to go back and look at those standards and your retrofit and do some risk calculations to see if there's any residual risk. And if there is any residual risk, then there will be another round of reductions on your facilities. And those residual risk standards are starting about now, in about a year, the first ones will come out, and those will run forward. The standards should be done by 2009, and then the implementation will run after that. So we're in the process right now, several layers of regulatory reductions going through.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cruz.
Residual risk, is that a theoretical model of what might be, or how do they put a real scientific base? I mean, and another question would be, I mean, if we're looking at dioxins and the least measurable amount, is there any correlation between that and actual risk to health?
Chairman Morgan, Representative Cruz, the first question, it will be a mathematical computation, because risk almost always is a purely mathematical computation. And to your second question, it is premised on the idea that for some compounds, carcinogens, there is no bottom to the risk. On some things that are not carcinogens, you can be exposed to a certain amount before there's a threshold. The theory is that on carcinogens, there is no bottom exposure that produces no risk. So the risk could be very, very tiny, but when you calculate it, it's there.
So, you know, obviously the carcinogen level there is way below what is in Budweiser, so I guess that's a whole other calculation. What we are doing here basically, or what EPA is doing here basically, is assuming that any risk is unacceptable and basing their assumption of risk purely on theory.
Madam Chair, Representative Cruz, I wouldn't go that far.
Okay.
A lot of EPA standards are based on what is an acceptable risk, but that varies depending on the pollutant and the situation. And frankly, you know, public policy drives some of that. I believe the public has almost no tolerance for risk from something like dioxin. But I believe the public probably has a fairly high tolerance for a risk like smog, ozone, because they like to drive cars. So the level of risk that is calculated goes into the calculation of the standards, and it's highly variable.
Which means that it's not necessarily scientifically based, public opinion based.
But the point of this is all going to be rolling forward over the next several years. Of the next. This is, and we cannot read this slide, but this is to give you some of the examples of the reductions we're going to get, and I'll just go through this quickly. I think the first one is reductions in emissions from organic chemical manufacturing since 1984. We're going to have a reduction of about 90% or 85% of emissions. The second one is mercury from municipal waste incineration. I think that was already in place, and that was goes down to about a reduction of 95%. Mercury from hospital incinerators goes down. I think that's in place in 2 years. That'll go down about 98%. Benzene from cars will be reduced around 75%, and formaldehyde from cars will be reduced about 80%. So this is an example of what will be kind of rolling through. Okay, we've already seen this slide, but I think this is an example of what can be done, going back to the air quality slide. And that is, when we put things in place and work together on them, we can have success stories, but you almost never hear of this. You've never seen this in the newspaper. Because it's not a real good story, I think. But we've made great strides. There are still some big problems. We have contamination of fish in the river, and that's just going to have to be dealt with. There are going to have to be studies done to look for the source of that. It's just never going to end. You know, it's going to go forward. But the message I wanted to leave you with is that things are getting done, and they're moving quickly, and we're on a good path.
Questions, comments?
Well, you're getting off easily. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That concludes our agenda. The Farm Bureau has asked us to reschedule their presentation, and we'll go ahead and do that. So having no further business before the committee this morning, the committee is adjourned.
Good job. I'm an editor.